Gamers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Gamers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to the latest summer special of Naylor's Natter. And this week I'm in conversation with the amazing Kat Howard. And in this week's podcast we discuss Lit Drive, hashtag Teacher 5 a Day, Maternity CPD, Women Ed and Imposter Syndrome. We also discuss Kat's new book, Stop Talking About Wellbeing, and why the time is absolutely right for a book like this. We discuss her book interviews with Sam Strickland, Daisy Christodoulou and Emma Shepherd. So grab the dog and the lead. Grab the running shoes or just put the kettle on and settle in for another Naylor's Natter. Okay, hi Kat and welcome to the podcast.
Hi Phil, how are you?
Yes, good, thank you. And thanks for giving up your time on your holidays to speak to us on the podcast. Much appreciated.
No problem.
Right, as listeners will know, we get into the what we used to call the X Factor question, but nobody knew what I was talking about. So it's just a gentle introductory question now, which is if you could just tell listeners a little bit about your journey to this point and what you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, no problems. I had quite a convoluted journey into teaching. So I came to teaching quite late and as a parent. And I think everyone has their own journey. But for me personally, I think both those things have kind of shaped where I've kind of got to in teaching. I left school after my A-levels. I got a little bit kind of disconnected with the education system and didn't really enjoy like the later part of education. And so I worked in banking for a previous amount of time and then relocated to the Northwest within the financial sector. And kind of, I was retail manager for the Northwest for quite a large high street bank for a period of years. Got a little bit, I don't know, jaded with the idea of, I kind of missed or I felt a lack of reward in what I was doing. It wasn't necessarily vocation. It's not very, I didn't find it very rewarding to essentially go to work to make money for somebody else. And so I took a year out, went to Cyprus, and then decided to go back to university and retrain as a teacher. Took a little bit longer than I expected, as I had, in the July I graduated and I had a placement on a PGC course lined up and then found out that I was pregnant with my first son. So deferred that place for a little while, took 3 years out and worked for a union as a workplace representative, which was really insightful. And then eventually got around to do my PGCE at Warwick. And have been teaching for, this is my eighth year now. So I've kind of moved through, I've done various different roles within school. So literacy coordinator, I was an assistant subject lead for English, and I now kind of take care of our more able students. So it's looking after that traditionally top 10%, but essentially trying to raise the bar for all students within the school that I work at in South Leicestershire.
Wow, so much to talk about there. And I said to you on the kind of introduction before when we came on, we were talking about this idea that it's not just a jingle, this idea of talking to teachers. It's very much part of this podcast is trying to root everything that we're talking about in the classroom, and that's very much where you still are. So that's hopefully that's going to be great, and that's going to come through in today's podcast. So just moving on to talk about some of your work that you've done. So listeners will be aware of your work with Lit Drive. Can you tell us about how you came up with that idea?
So Lit Drive was, I think, 6 years ago now, and I was got the role of literacy coordinator at the school that I'm currently at, and it felt like a really solitary role. It was a little bit alien to me to kind of carry out this job in school that only one person has, and so you're kind of put in charge of, you know, you're doing literacy, and there was no real kind of support network because of the fact that you're the only person doing it. And so I set up just a shared Google Drive, put some feelers out on Twitter and said, you know, is anybody else literacy coordinator, do you want to share some stuff? And it went from there, really, and we kind of grew to the point that it transferred over to like a Dropbox, and got to a point where there was about 800 contributors. Last May, I kind of took over the Team English Dropbox and amalgamated that from Freya O'Dell and Fiona Ritson. and put it all together in one spot, and it was becoming really unmanageable. I was getting about 50 requests a day from English teachers and literacy coordinators to join and share resources, and people would send over stuff for me to upload, and it was just becoming a full-time job in itself. So I thought I'd make things, you know, loads easier by trying to design a website and build a website from scratch. So that's what we did last year. So I used my maternity leave and the support of coaching from the MTP Tube project to kind of get my head around what that would look like and design a website. And so literally I've now, we're at 12,500 members a year on, which is incredible. The site hosts resources for English teachers. We have a guest blog platform for teachers to kind of share their experiences, as well as a peer coaching program that we coordinate every year. We had, I think, 200 people sign up to last year. We've kind of put a bit of a cap on it for this year to refine the process. And we've just branched into regional events, so subject-specific, really knowledge-rich regional events for English teachers. The regional events really came from kind of recognising a gap in knowledge-based, subject-specific CPD for teachers. There seems to be a real gap, especially, I don't know what it looks like for other subjects, but for English teachers, obviously, your knowledge and knowledge of a text is really where you're going to harness your practice in the classroom. And so I personally was finding a lot of experience if you kind of move schools and you go from teaching, you know, one Shakespeare text to another, for example, it's almost like starting again. It's almost like starting at the beginning of your career again, because you come into a text with fresh eyes for the first time and you're almost having to stay one step ahead of students. And so I wanted to fill that gap of going back to, you know, teachers are our best resource, of returning to love of the subject, being able to set up an event or a series of events where teachers can share their love of English and building a kind of community around, what we refer to as like curriculum community, to kind of quote Christine Council, but that idea of English teachers having a place to kind of share best practice, but share their knowledge of the text. I think it's a resource that we could really tap into more. But essentially, LitDrive is there to kind of empower English teachers, and hopefully, as I've got from some of the feedback, to kind of stop people leaving, especially English teachers. But yeah, to reduce workload really through empowerment of the subject, but kind of utilising teachers as they are our greatest resource.
No, definitely. And well-being and all that sort of topic is definitely going to be part of the podcast later on. Do you mind if I just pick up on a little bit of what you talked about there? So you said that you did a lot of the setting up of the website during your maternity leave, and you've talked about how you've maximised that maternity leave. So what other things were you doing during that period, as well as obviously childcare and everything else?
As well as knocking up that website. I mean, the MTPT project I kind of found in really early days of my maternity leave with my second son last year. Emma Shepherd launched the organisation 3 years ago, and it's really about kind of providing an outlet should teachers choose to, for parents on maternity leave or with children, to kind of maximise that time away from school. Because I think if you know typical teachers, we are quite high functioning, and you know we like to keep busy, and so it was really kind of giving people the choice of how to pursue CPD while you have that time away from schools. And so the MTPT carry out an accreditation. So it's a two-part accreditation. Module one, you do while you're on maternity leave or paternity leave. And then module two is whatever you carry out in module one, whatever you wanted to explore or action research you wanted to carry out, and how you'll plan to take that back into the classroom. And so there are various regions in the UK that are being funded in order to do that. And so you have three coaching sessions with a qualified coach. And it's all focused around what it is that you want to achieve. So for me, obviously, it was to, you know, develop LitDrive as a provision. But the other things that I kind of carried out around having tiny babies in the house, I mean, it really kind of comes back to what you're going to do with it. And so a lot of the CPD that I carried out, I wanted to make sure that it was meaningful and I wasn't just kind of reading stuff for the sake of reading it, or, you know, it was really kind of trying to be a bit more mindful about what I was going to do with it. So podcasts, your podcast, really helpful for my maternity this year, to kind of think about what I'm doing and what I can learn from other people's context. That's been really, really insightful. Teacher Tap is also obviously a brilliant way of making a, you know, of CPD in a really small space of time. I really like the fact that Teacher Tap gives you, you know, like how many minutes it's going to take you to read this, and it's all about kind of fitting things in around that kind of that schedule, and the fact that when you have children you can't predict what your free time is going to look like sometimes. As my toddler decided to last night stay up till about 11 o'clock, so you never know how, you know, that time that you're going to have. We carried out a lot of cultural outings, so you know, National Trust membership kind of kept me sane last year, I think, but with my English head on, that's fantastic, because obviously it's steeped in a lot of history and you have a lot of kind of literature narrative to a lot of the National Trust properties. And just kind of getting to grips with subject knowledge again was really nice. It's nice having that time to reflect, to, you know, read up on poetry and get away from kind of the busyness of school, where you end up with this to-do list of things that you really want to do and you maybe don't necessarily get the time to do them. But I have tried to, because I had two maternity leaves quite close together, I have tried to this year, like I said, coming back to that idea of, okay, well, what am I doing with my maternity leave? But what am I going to do with it? I carried out a lot of school visits locally. I recently went to Dustin School, at Sam Strickland School in Northampton, which was really interesting. I went over to see Anna Hunt at her school, which is just over the other side of Leicester, as part of the Lionheart Trust, and really wanted to kind of think about what I could take back to my own practice from that. And I think take advantage of the fact that when you're in school, again, you don't necessarily have that time to go out and see what people are doing in other schools. So I wanted to kind of think about, okay, well, how can I use this time to do all the things that maybe I don't necessarily have the luxury of doing when I'm working full-time in a school, in a classroom.
No, fantastic, fantastic. And also, I've noticed recently, so, I mean, I've been involved, I say involved, tentatively involved with, you know, the hashtag Teacher Five a Day that Martin's been doing. Yeah. Which is brilliant, but I think that, have you put the running shoes back on as well? Are you doing a little bit of that? Is that coming back into part of your routine as well?
Yeah, quarter to six this morning. Yeah, well, let's see, depending on how my children sleep, that's kind of been the stumbling factor for me for the last 2 years. But Martin started up Teach Five a Day. What we're talking, I think it's 2012 now, 2013, and it exploded. It was just kind of, you know, on the back of obviously the NHS Five a Day, of five elements as to how we can kind of regulate and have a little bit of self-care about teacher well-being. The five elements of Teacher Five a Day were notice, connect, learn, volunteer, and exercise. And this kind of idea that, you know, if we can distill our well-being down to these five different elements. The response, I mean, Martin, I don't speak too much on Martin's behalf, but Martin's done fantastic things with it. Wellbeing policies have been written off the back of Teacher Five a Day that are now implemented in schools. He's actually working with, and I'm sure he won't mind me saying, the National Careers Week, and we've just written up the copy for him for the leaflet that's going to go out to all the students as to, you know, how to kind of manage your wellbeing as part of your career, which is, you know, amazing. But there's been kind of almost spin-offs from the Teacher Five a Day. So there was like Teacher Five a Day Sew, which, you know, completely out of my comfort zone, but a lot of teachers sharing a craft work. There was a sketch one, a cooking one, a reading project. So I carried out like a Teacher Five a Day read, and we'd share, ambitiously for 50 books a year to read, and teachers would share their reading list and what they'd been reading over the summer, or in over the summer period. We kind of used the stole the children's, the National Library's six books over the summer and did that as an initiative as well. But behind kind of, you know, the community and the almost, you know, the fun side of it, there's actually been a really sustained way of demonstrating to people how you can, you know, look after and be a little bit mindful of your well-being in as a teacher, because it is a high pressure job and it is a very fast paced job, and I think that it's really important that you just kind of have that awareness about you of that we need to look after ourselves, really.
No, definitely, and he's been so good for that in terms of, you know, I think about some of the stuff that I've been doing in terms of well-being, and, you know, I get on the hashtag of gentle jog because it's more of a jog than it is of a run, but in volunteering, I mean, the volunteering...
That's definitely how mine looked this morning.
Well, listen, that's exactly how mine is. I often go to these conferences and people say, oh, I see you run up and down these beaches. I think, you really wouldn't want to see me run up and down these beaches. This isn't, it's not like David Hasselhoff on Baywatch or something like that, you know, it's kind of a shuffle.
No, I'm more Phoebe in Central Park.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why it happens at 5:30.
Well, it's the best time to go out, like you said, to work it around the kids, but in terms of my kids have cottoned onto this volunteering idea, so we try to get involved in park run, but I've volunteered quite a few times, but they seem to like that more than the running now, so it's like, well, can we go park run, but can we volunteer? I'm thinking, I see what you're doing, you know, I don't have to actually run anywhere or do anything if I can just stand around
the other people
and clap, yeah.
Brilliant.
Right, just moving on, Kat, if we may, into I know that a popular presentation that you delivered at WomanEd recently was on imposter syndrome. Now, I'm really, really interested in all of this. So could you tell listeners a little bit about what you talked about in imposter syndrome and some of its features?
Yeah, Carly Waterman invited me to the WomanEd last month to talk about imposter syndrome. And it was on the back of a conversation that Carly and I had had over coffee about not listening to 1% and all of that kind of, you know, being strong in your convictions and making decisions and not listening to that person on your shoulder. And so it led me to kind of read up on, I've always kind of suffered with imposter syndrome. And I think if you speak to anybody, as soon as we start talking about it, everybody has had that experience of imposter syndrome, because we don't like to talk about it. And so it made me read up and research around imposter syndrome and, you know, where it's likely to occur and its kind of main features and stuff. It was really interesting because it's much more likely to occur in women than men normally. Men just tend to ignore it as a coping mechanism, whereas women will be open and talk about it a lot more. But the higher up the scale that you go, and so the more responsibility you have, the more that you seem to suffer as a result, which I thought was really interesting as well. Because I think there's that kind of idea, that self-doubt and the kind of limitations that we put on ourselves with imposter syndrome makes us think that however much we've achieved, that we don't necessarily deserve it, that we're not worthy of it. And so it's really interesting. And so it's kind of meta in itself, because it's essentially a condition that makes us question reality. It's a little bit like the Matrix, imposter syndrome, that it, you know, that the more you kind of buy into this self-doubt and that you're not necessarily worthy, and somebody's going to run into your classroom and, you know, ask for your P45, hand you a P45, sorry, the more that we kind of the more it leads us to make bad, poor decisions, or kind of feed off the negative aspects rather than the positive aspects of our teaching. You do tend to find imposter syndrome is quite prevalent within teachers, and I think that's because of the fact that it we're quite reflective. And we're always looking to improve. And so if you put yourself in an occupation where there's no necessarily an end point, then imposter syndrome is almost going to come in hand in hand with that, because it's going to constantly make you feel as if you're not done. The main kind of features that I explored and talked about WomanEd were that kind of self-doubt, but also the labels and the language that we use for ourselves. If you suffer from imposter syndrome, you tend to be quite self-deprecating, or you make excuses for, if somebody gives you praise, for example, you make an excuse for you talk about being lucky, or, you think that everything is a fluke. And that you haven't necessarily earned it, or that your achievements are kind of down to something else or some external factor. And I think it's about kind of just, I talked about it at WomanEd, not necessarily tackling it or combating it. I don't believe that's the way around dealing with imposter syndrome. I think it's just having that awareness that to some degree, we all have this syndrome that we need to kind of work with. It's almost about making it your friend as such, that it's about being aware of it so that we can empower ourselves to tweak the language that we use and help that to feed into the decisions that we make and the actions that we have as teachers. And so I think you have to view imposter syndrome almost as a positive feature that, yes, okay, it makes you maybe not shout about your achievements, but the achievements that you do tend to shout about, you recognise as really worth shouting about and really worth sharing. And so it does kind of almost set a kind of, you've got this kind of regulator as such with imposter syndrome, which sometimes can be quite handy. It means that when we do celebrate that the achievements that we have gravity to us. It also helps. I talked a lot at Women Ed about choosing your crowd and making sure that you have people around you, not necessarily yes people, but people that will be honest with you, but are actually really, really encouraging of your achievements and really supportive of that. I think that's incredibly important, because if you are suffering from imposter syndrome and you're actually coming forward to somebody and saying, actually, I'm really proud of this thing that I've achieved and I really want to share it with you, but you've got somebody receptive on the other end going, do you know what, that's absolutely fantastic. I think ultimately, imposter syndrome is metacognition at teacher level, really, because it's that constant self-awareness and reflection in what you're doing and how you're behaving, and it kind of it ensures that there's a real humility to what we're doing, I think.
No, absolutely. And I was just thinking, I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but in the conversations that I usually have leading up to recording one of these podcasts, or even in the conversation before we start to go on, nearly everybody that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to some people who would be considered to be, sort of leading lights and big names in terms of, education, and everybody comes on and says, are you sure that you want to speak to me about this? Are you sure that I've got enough things to say about this? I'm really nervous speaking to you about this.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm the one who's nervous about speaking to you about these kind of things. And you're right about the kind of profile of teachers. I've yet to meet anybody on here who's come on and said, yes, I've got loads to say and you should listen to what I've got to say. Everyone's been really humble and really, approachable in terms of what they think. And they're not sure whether they've got anything to say more than anybody else.
We have a really similar thing with the Lit Drive, that we found with the Lit Drive CPD events, because the whole idea behind the regional events was that I wanted, teachers in the classroom to be sharing their knowledge and kind of empower, especially your experienced teachers that have chosen to stay in the classroom, that haven't necessarily chosen to go, through the leadership group or take time out of the classroom. I wanted to utilise those teachers that have got so much experience. And every single person that I have had or asked or approached to speak an event has said, I'm so nervous. The idea of speaking to my peers is just terrifying. And, and it was really interesting that the event that we held at Leicester, that the entire group of all seven speakers stood around having exactly the same conversation with each other and almost feeding off each other, because we had, I'm sure we won't mind me saying, Craig Bonnie Meekins was sort of saying, I really admire you, to Marcello Giovanelli, and then Marcello Giovanelli saying to Amazon, oh, I really admire you, and I've seen you do this, and I've seen you on Twitter, and it was almost this kind of this chain event of just people feeding into each other in a really positive way. And it's that's what I mean about imposter syndrome and humility, is that actually it created a really encouraging conversation, I think, with everybody kind of saying, actually, what, you've got nothing to worry about, because I really admire you, which I think that's really heartwarming.
No, definitely. And there's so much, experience in the classroom of people that is almost what we need to hear. And that's one of the reasons for doing the podcast in the first place, was to say, I put it on the jingle, just talking to teachers. I know it's a catchy jingle, but it is supposed to be genuinely the ethos behind the podcast. Obviously, we'll get expert views on various different things from people that are not necessarily classroom-based, but always like to come back to people who are doing the job day in, day out. And there's so much insight from people that are doing that.
Yeah, and I think that the experts that you have had on as well are those people that do have that humility, that are really kind of open. I don't know, it's a little bit cliche, but that lifelong learner approach, that idea that I think it's Mary Meyer said something about, the more you learn, the deeper you go, and the more you realise you don't know. And it's that kind of, that kind of really open leader, I think, that's the most inspiring.
No, definitely. And yeah, just to echo that, anybody that I've then met personally, you know, at conferences or whatever, it's been fantastic. And, you know, I'll give him a shout out here for Ollie Cav. So Oliver Caviglioli, you know, when I went to speak to him at Research Ed Rugby, and just because obviously I'd never actually spoken to him, I'd obviously done an interview with him, but I'd never actually spoken to him. And he was absolutely brilliant, you know. And then he's gone and done a logo for me and everything as well. So, you know, shout out to him for being a great guy.
I know, right. I looked after Mary Myatt's bag at Research Rugby, and she didn't realise how much it meant to me, I don't think.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Right, if we could just move on a little bit, Kat, to talk about something that's really exciting. So you've got this new book coming out fairly soon with John Catt, and it's called Stop Talking About Wellbeing. So how did this come about, and why do you think the time is right now for a book like this?
Such a great question. It's been one of those things that's been in the back of my mind for a really, really long time, and it wasn't like this, you know, light bulb, I'm going to write a book moment. It's almost been a long time brewing. I was having a lot of conversations with a lot of teachers who were frustrated, or, you know, conversations that would end with, we should write a book about this. Mm-hmm. You know, that makes no sense. We should write a book about this. I just kind of started reading into the things that I was getting frustrated with in education, coming from a corporate setting. There were so many aspects of teaching that I found to be really nonsensical or illogical compared to a corporate setting, or that didn't necessarily benefit teachers or help teachers or support teachers. So isn't it a kind of example of that? And I've talked about this on Twitter today about the summer break, and the kind of physical and mental impact of taking an extended break from work, and what that necessarily does to you. I'm not trying to take, you know, teacher's holiday away, let me be very clear on that. But having a little bit of awareness, and schools having an awareness of what that, you know, the impact of that on their staff, and how they can maybe put steps in place. Or there are certain schools that I look at that are doing particular things in their context to support their staff with how to kind of manage the physical and mental impact of summers. But it's things like, you know, we have staff that will go in for results day every single year, and I couldn't think of a single other profession where we have this expectation of expecting, you know, a whole staff body to go into their workplace for a period of time during the holiday, and that kind of, and it's not necessarily this angry response to teaching and the teaching structure as a profession, but there are just aspects of it that I think that we're not necessarily it's not necessarily joined up thinking. Why is this a good time? And it makes me really a little bit frustrated at how many teachers I know who have left the profession, how many teachers I trained with that have left the profession, so many friends of mine that are teachers that have left the profession because they feel like there's not another option, but how many teachers nationwide, and I've talked about this on the lead up to creating Lit Drive, and essentially that's what, you know, Lit Drive is my contribution to attempt to stop that, because it genuinely saddens me at how many people that we have that leave what I view as, and you know, I probably shouldn't say this for hope of future employment, a job that I would almost do for free. But you know, that teaching is such a fantastic profession. How on earth have we got people in a position where they feel like they need to leave? And so ultimately, if only one person reads this book and takes something away that means they don't want to leave teaching anymore, then I'll be happy with that. That's enough for me. The book kind of works in two stages. So I've looked at, we talked about research informed, rather than research based, research informed, ways to look at within the classroom and resourcing and curriculum design. And speak to experts around that. But then the second half, an assessment of feedback and marking, and the second half of the book looks at more the kind of the psychology that we have around schools. So things like relationships, school systems, the school calendar and how that's designed to kind of support staff in schools, or like I said, the kind of the summer break and things like that. So how are, but also how schools can be not just family friendly. We talked to Emma Shepherd about family friendly schools, but people friendly. How ultimately we can create schools that that retain staff because they don't want to go anywhere else. You know, that kind of that Richard Branson response almost to employing people, that, you know, to train your staff up to a point and treat your staff to a point that, that they could leave if they wanted to, but they don't necessarily want to because it's such a great place to work. And that's what we should, I believe, what we should be doing with our schools.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what I liked about it, and you know, in our conversations to talk about setting up this podcast, when obviously I approached you to ask you whether you'd come on, is that you're using your expertise in research to help teachers take ownership of their workload. So what kind of insights have you used there, and how have you talked about that in the book?
Yeah, so like I said before, there's kind of class three-based sections of the book that look at the science of learning, cognitive learning, you know, as well with cognitive load theory. And I've taken a lot of really insightful information from the learning scientists, the value of learning that they did with Ollie Cav as well. And so that the kind of the cognitive science, where I think that there are elements of our classroom practice in schools at the moment that maybe we're replicating work, or we're not necessarily carrying out resourcing or classroom delivery or assessment in the way that it's designed to do. And so I look at kind of educational research, but then, as I say, for the second half, there's quite a lot of psychology in there around, for example, the article that I shared the other day from some Dutch psychologists around the idea of leisure sickness and actually what, you know, prolonged amounts of cortisol and adrenaline production does to your body when you're working at such a high pace of time. So there is educational research in there, but I also kind of take research and readings from other aspects that I feel can feed into education as well. I think it's really, really important. I know that we've kind of battered this around a lot recently about context being key, and so I've got a lot of teacher narrative in there. I don't think a book based on research alone to inform practice is possible, because it's the narrative, the teacher narrative in the classroom that helps us to kind of make change. And so there's a lot of kind of excerpts from teachers, excerpts from a physio, for example, and looking at kind of how we look after ourselves physically when we're in a classroom environment. But also, I've kind of taken interviews from experts. So there's contributions in there from school leaders that I think will be valuable to teachers as well.
No, brilliant. Do you mind if I pick up on a couple of those? So, yeah. I mean, I saw Sam Strickland at Research Ed Rugby, and I contacted mm-hmm. him. I was really, really impressed with what he said. So what kind of insights was he giving in terms of a school leader feeding into your book?
Yeah, so each kind of section ends a particular expert that I thought would be really insightful to kind of contribute to that particular area. So with Sam, I've talked around a lot about relationships and how he's used kind of staff relationships to create a massive culture shift and you know the work that he's done with Dustin. In the last kind of year or so, he does completely openly hold as a testament to his staff and how they've been behind him and really kind of bought into this knowledge-rich curriculum. We also shared Dustin's workload charter, which I found really interesting. And it's only really a kind of document, and I'll kind of explain it a little bit in a minute, but it's only really a document that is being used by a handful of schools in the UK. But I find it really kind of powerful to empower teachers in schools so that they're all on the same page. So the workload charter in Dustin kind of talks around almost a commitment to the staff that's being made from the leadership team, that time will be given. And so he talks a lot about, very publicly angsty around emails. And he said at rugby, you know, if an email is more than two lines long, I'm going to come and find you to talk about it because it deserves a meeting. And so, you know, that, for example, Justin don't, so they don't send emails outside of school time and weekends. And they don't expect to receive emails either, so staff don't send emails, because it is that idea of getting back to, you know, the I know it's going back to basics, but, you know, the art of a conversation and having a conversation with someone and how much quicker you can get to a resolution and move productively than dropping emails. And unfortunately, a school environment when we're all isolated in our classroom doesn't necessarily always lend itself to having conversations with people. But yeah, it's just kind of one element of the workload charter that I think is that other schools could really benefit from. But also Sam's put a lot of time into staff development and staff CPD. I mean, if anybody looks at his CPD menu for the next year, it's incredible. But it's that kind of that value of, and he, you know, repeatedly says this about the teacher being the expert. And so, yeah, I thought Sam would be a really interesting person to kind of share his experiences, because I think people could take a lot from that.
No, definitely, definitely. So much to pick up there. So one, yes, absolutely, in terms of the culture that is created for the staff at the school. I mean, I was struck as someone who was sat at the back, because one of the benefits of doing a podcast is that, yes, lots of people listen to it, but no one knows what you look like. So I could happily sit at the back of Research Ed Rugby, just oblivious to anything that's going on. That was great. But I noticed that a lot of his staff were there in the talk at the front,
yeah.
You know, and that was really palpable. You could feel the kind of culture at the school was really, really good there. And the other thing is the emails. Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate to work for a great school that we do that as well, in terms of no emails and conversations and face-to-faces. What I have heard, though, now, I don't know if you've heard this, Kat, as well, a few sneaky ways around the email thing is that lots of staff groups now seem to have a WhatsApp group to get around the emails at weekends. But that's just as bad, isn't it?
I've just written literally last week an excerpt. So there are kind of interludes in the book where, you know, essentially what it is this combination of, oh, I really want to include this and I don't know where it'll fit in a section. So I've got lots of kind of interludes where either that or I'm really tired and I just want to write about this one thing tonight. So yeah. I've got kind of a combination of different things. But one of the things that I explored with Reece Denham, who's a head of English down in South Warwickshire, is WhatsApp, and this idea of WhatsApp kind of creeping in. And you know, my department have actually got a group WhatsApp that I don't sign up to, because I think the lines are so blurred when you start creating WhatsApp. Because with WhatsApp groups, you're essentially setting the expectation that, one, I don't know, we're brain surgeons, that there's that kind of that urgency that anybody would ever need you for anything once you leave work. I don't know, but also that there's that kind of that line, isn't there, that it lends itself to the idea that that there isn't a boundary, and that you're either going to miss out on something or that there's an obligation to be a part of that. We have a gigantic, very, very busy Lit Drive WhatsApp group for our regional advocates that really we should just rename to Books and Babies, because that's all any of us really talk about. But when I appoint regional advocates, I do make it very, very clear in the job description and everything that I send out, you know, there's a WhatsApp group, feel free to duck out, there's absolutely no obligation, and everything that you need to know about will be sent out via a monthly update on an email. So there's no requirement for you to be in there. Because we're English teachers, I think everybody signs up and then just talks about Books and Babies. but there isn't that expectation, and I think that's really dangerous in a job like teaching, to kind of, yeah, like you say, it's a workaround almost, you know. And it's too instant. People can say what they want in the heat of the moment. It's not necessarily with thought or reflection. I think it also really raises questions around, you know, IT policy and kind of acceptable use.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's got the problem the wrong way around, hasn't it? I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? You're not addressing the very problem that you've set up this rule for in the first place. And, you know, if you think about things like, so WhatsApp group, so that you can get messages out. If it's as you say, and it's voluntary and it's opt and it's nice because teachers are connecting to each other, teachers are talking to each other, that's all fine. But if it's part of a way to subvert the rule, then it's pointless. It's like delay send. I've got a bit of a bugbear. I'm off on one now, aren't I? About delay send as well, because Delay Send isn't solving the problem. It's just storing up issues for, you know, schools that I've heard.
Yeah,
7 o'clock on a Monday morning, you suddenly have 20 emails that people have knocked off over the weekend. So you're almost starting the week.
I mean, I work in a school where I've worked in other schools where emails have been far more of a prevalent problem. Mm. And the kind of average that I've worked on, average email in inbound that I've worked on would, you know, be 40 upwards and would start at 5:30 a.m. And you just think, you know what, I don't know, what kind of message are we sending out to people? Why would we send emails at 11 p.m. or 4 a.m. in the morning or 5:30 in the morning? Because it's either a badge of honour, and actually, do you know what, I'm concerned for you if you're sending emails at that time in the morning, because it means that work is on your mind. And it doesn't necessarily, especially as a middle leader or a senior leader, it doesn't send a positive message to the rest of your staff, because it does have an undercurrent of obligation. But if it's okay for me, why are you not doing it? And I think that just to remove any of that, even that interpretation, just don't do it. And then it removes all sense of doubt, doesn't it? But I know full well that I would much rather a drink every Friday after work than a WhatsApp group any day of the week.
Definitely. I'd love to see a return to days like that, but unfortunately these days it's normally, what is it for me? It's a dance class, then drama class, then swimming, and then football. And none of those things are for me, by the way, of course. But you know.
It's not great. Even the dance class.
Well, I could do with one, but no. Right, just moving on a little bit, Kat, if we can, in terms of, so the book, you've talked to other people as well. So do you mind if I ask you a little bit about, you've spoken with Daisy Christodoulou, for example. So what did you talk to Daisy about, and how did that feed into the book?
Yeah, that was brilliant. So Daisy very kindly gave up her time to talk to me about assessment generally. We were talking about no more marking, and I think the concept of comparative judgment is incredible, and it's really kind of opened my eyes to the assessment systems that are currently in schools, maybe how we could be doing things in a better way, you know, more effective way. So comparative judgment is exactly what it says on the tin, that you compare two pieces of work, you decide which one is the better of the two, and it essentially orders it for you. No More Marking's website can give a far more comprehensive and detailed, with examples, description than I can. But I think it's an incredible way of moving. Daisy and I talked a lot about current assessment, how it doesn't necessarily work, how, because of the fact that accountability is attached to assessment, it's warped what we're doing, and we don't necessarily gather the data that we need to gather. So we went back to talking about interleaving, multiple choice questions and the value of those, and how maybe they've become devalued because they're seen as simple, or, you know, not what the exam needs, when actually it's about testing the knowledge, and students, if they know the knowledge, will be able to then apply it in written assessment, and you know, and we kind of talked about around the future of assessment and what that could look like. So yeah, it was really exciting, kind of, you know, essentially changed the world in theory, just kind of put it into practice. But you know, she speaks a lot of sense in a lot of the things that we're doing around assessment don't necessarily make sense in schools, and not necessarily, not just from a workload point of view. And this is kind of the, if I had to explain the core of the book, it is getting back to that a lot of what we do is impacting workload because it's not effective. And I think that there's a lot of, Daisy and I particularly talked about this, that there's a lot of martyrdom attached to teaching, where people are very sceptical of things like no more marking, or generally things that reduce workload, because if it's easier, then it seems to be that it's corner cutting, when actually a lot of the best things in the world work because they're easy, because they're simple and straightforward. And I think that it's getting away from that idea that just because it's simpler, just because it works better, doesn't necessarily mean that it, you know, it's an easy ride, and we need to make things difficult for ourselves.
No, absolutely. And this is why this book is so important. And I spoke to Mark McCourt last week, and he was talking about, you know, his insight in terms of having careers outside of teaching and inside teaching, similar way to what you've talked about, that there's some things that teachers do that are utterly bonkers, you know, in terms of why would you do those things? And in any other industry, you just wouldn't even think about doing that. And you're right about this, the martyrdom idea in terms of, well, oh, you know, I got up at this time in the morning and I worked till this time. I mean, I've had it with training this year in terms of, they said to me, right, Phil, because I'm responsible for the trainees, what time do we have to stay till? I said, well, you don't have to stay till any time. He went, well, the provider, and I won't mention the provider, and we've worked with lots of providers, so it could be anybody, has suggested that we should really be one of the first in and one of the last out to show that we're really serious. And I said, well, that's probably not the way to show that you're serious. You know, if we're attracting a broad sort of range of people into teaching, if someone needs to leave at the end of the day, fine. That's absolutely
fine. But even
fine.
Now, and I think I describe teaching, I describe education as a flawed franchise. So we're essentially like a group of really badly managed subways, in the way that one school can be doing a fantastic job of looking after staff and looking after and being really considerate of workload and well-being. And then down the road, 5 miles, down the road, you've got a school that is completely disjointed, not necessarily taking account or showing necessarily, or maybe even with the best of intentions, but not demonstrating that they're looking after their staff or that they've considered workload. And what a strange place to be, because in a corporate, and I think as soon as you use the word corporate in teaching, it's got quite negative connotations, but actually in a corporate organisation, like the financial sector, you went to one place and people were being treated and policy was being followed in exactly the same way as the next branch on the street. And that is how effective places operate, that there's a real kind of parity between one place and the next. And we don't have that in teaching. Now, I appreciate why, I'm not naive to the fact that, local authority doesn't on the whole exist anymore. I do appreciate that it's not that simplistic. But when it comes to what we're doing in schools, I think we need to be much smarter in the way, and like I said, like you said, detach that martyrdom.
No, and I should just say while I'm on it, in terms of, I'm lucky to work in a place where I've got an executive head teacher, so Stephen Tierney is very big on, if things aren't 9 out of 10, don't do them. And he genuinely means, don't do them. And I've also got a head teacher, Simon, who obviously won't be listening to this, but he's a real he's a real person. But what I mean by that is,
not even the beginning and end.
He's a father of four who understands what it's like in terms of workload, work-life balance, all of those kind of things. And his skills of empathy with the staff are fantastic. So the culture that he creates in the school, I'm very fortunate to work there. And he's been a big driver in terms of the email policy and, this idea that, if you want to come in at this time, you want to go at that time, that's fine. And flexible working and all those side of things. So there are some good examples as well. Yeah. But this book is going to be brilliant
there are,
in terms
of
people getting
and
more
that's what
of those
I want
good examples.
To focus on in the book. I don't want it to turn into I don't want it to turn into a school bash and give people lots of horror stories. I asked about examples of unreasonable demands on Twitter the other day and the other week, and had somebody saying, this is such a depressing thread. I'm like, I know, but there's a counterbalance to this. There's always a counterbalance, and there are people doing fantastic things, and that's what we really have to learn from. That's what we have to feed off. And Ross McCullen, who was executive principal for the Midlands Academy Trust, she always says, if it doesn't reduce workload and it doesn't improve practice, don't do it. And it's that simple.
No, it absolutely is. And absolutely all the examples that you've given so far have been of really positive examples of this. And obviously the book's going to have lots of those. So talking about the book, when's the book going to come out? And are you out talking about it? Are you out working with teachers on the kind of suggestions that are in there?
It'll be out January next year. It's currently available to pre-order on Amazon, which is really, really exciting. Might have to actually, finish writing it. So that's really exciting. I'm really excited to talk about it with teachers, because I want it to provide solutions, but I also want it to raise questions further up the scale. So I do want to provide solutions on an individual level for classroom teachers, so that they can do something and take it away and feel slightly more empowered. I speak to a lot of teachers through kind of founding Lit Drive. I get so many emails and messages from teachers that are stretched the limit. Or alternatively, for all of those that are saying I'm really stretched to the limit and I need this and I want this and can you help me with this, on the other side of that, I get so many testimonies saying thank you so much. I had a lady who came up to me, and it was really touching, at the Leicester CPD event, who said, do you know what, I've really struggled the last year, and if it wasn't for Lit Drive, I wouldn't still be a teacher now. And, you know, and that's a testament to the whole Lit Drive team, you know, group of over 30 now. But that's the kind of that's what I want people to take away from it, that there's ways of empowering, you know. I think sometimes at schools you can feel a little bit out of control of maybe necessarily you know, things that you're being instructed to do, or your working conditions almost, you know, and you don't always have necessarily full control over your workload, and so it's kind of taking that away. I'm kind of talking to people around it at the moment. So I'm at Research Ed in Northampton in October. I've also heard whispers, and hopefully if I put it on here, it will definitely come true, about Research Ed Leicester next year. So so that'll be exciting. But yeah, I'm back at work in September from my second maternity leave. So I'm hoping to try and fit in travelling around to the Lit Drive CPD events locally to me as well, and just kind of, I just really enjoy talking to English teachers about my subject. So, and we've got some incredible speakers lined up. So, yeah, I'll try and get out and about as much as I can. And I'm hoping to get to Pixel in October as well.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, we'll put links to all of that. So we'll put links to Amazon for where you can pre-order. We'll put links to your website and to your blog as well, and to all of the events that you're talking about, Lit Drive, and to Research Ed. So did you say Research Ed Northampton are you going to?
It's the start of October.
Start of October, yeah. And, you know, Research
Ed... I sound a little bit like the Sam Strickland advert.
Well, listen, it's a good advert, though, isn't it? Let's be right. It is a good advert. I mean, you know, we're quite happy to advertise. I mean, the Jason Statham comparison, I mean, we're not going to go that far, are we? We'll leave it at that, but... yeah, it is a good advert apart from that. So, yeah, I'm happy to signpost people towards Sam. Definitely. Definitely. Right, Kat, just to say thank you so much for giving up your time and your holidays, for going through all of that. I learned so much from these podcasts. Honestly, it's the best CPD for me in terms of finding out all the expertise that's out there. And thank you for everything that you're doing to shine a light on other people's expertise that's out there and signposting people to them. So thanks again for your time. Really appreciate it.
No, hopefully, thank you. I really appreciate it. I also want to say just thank you for the podcast, because honestly, it's been really, really insightful for the last 6 months the last 6 months while I've been on maternity leave. So yeah, you've kept me company as I walk around the streets at 9 a.m. getting a baby back to sleep. So appreciate it.
Well, thanks for saying that, because it's become a bit of a thing. This, I was just doing a one earlier on, and it's become a kind of a thing where people either gentle jog to, so Martin will like that because if you have a hashtag gentle jog, or it's become a dog walk thing. So I do a regular dog walk for my mum's dog who's 15, so he's not very keen on it. So I do that to Craig Barton's podcast, but 2 hours is a bit too long for 15-year-old Jack Russell.
I was going to say that some of those are long. I have to do them in two sittings. I'm not very good at an extended podcast.
No. Well, that's part of the reason for this one being a little bit shorter, but it's interesting to see what people do. So I think walking around, I mean, I remember those days as well, walking around to get children to sleep. I mean, mine are a little bit older now, so
walking in circles around the block.
I've got one voice that I can't wake up, not one that won't go to sleep. I've got one who wants to stay up till 11 o'clock and doesn't want to lie until midday, and the other one, yeah, the other one's the 5:30 in the morning. So I know what you mean by that. But listen, thanks again, really, really appreciate it, and great to speak to you. Like I said, hopefully I'll get to actually meet you one of these days. That'll be good as well.
I don't know how we'd managed it at rugby, but yeah,
Hello everyone, you are listening to my dad on the podcast Naylor's Natter.
I so enjoyed talking to Kat there, and the conversation continued off air for as long as it did on air, and I'm really grateful to Kat for being both a listener and a guest. So moving into the shameless plugs section, and we're now moving into the almost back to school period, so we're going to be moving back to the regular Friday podcast, and I've got some very exciting developments coming up, including some partnerships with leading CPD providers. And Naylor's Natter has got some exciting guests in the pipeline, including Dame Alison Peacock and Doug Lamoff, so watch this space. Hope everyone has enjoyed the summer break and is ready and raring to go for another year. I know that I am. So see you next time on Nailers Natter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.